With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we hear from an expert on what he thinks will have a new farm bill. But we start today out at a Commodity Classic, which wrapped up over the weekend in Houston, Texas. Commodity Classic features a robust schedule of more than 30 educational sessions, two trade show floors, with more than 430 exhibitors featuring the latest in technology, equipment, and innovation, inspiring speakers, unique tours, and the opportunity to network with thousands of farmers from across the nation. I joined these several thousand people there over the last week and got to talk with many of them.
Jeff Kaselny, I'm Cereals Account Management Lead for Westbred and Bayer Crop Science.
All right, well, I want to start off with talking about, if we can talk about the yields winners and the contest. Tell me a little bit about the contest and how it went this year.
Yeah, no, it was a great contest again. Certainly, you know, some new winners, some of the ones that won before. But, you know, in general, we're really proud. There's 24 national winners. 11 of those national winners this past year planted Westbred products. So, you know, we're proud of that, and we're hosting them here in Houston this week to, you know, celebrate their accomplishment. Pretty outstanding results. I mean, our Westbred winners, the yield range was from 109 bushels to 211 bushels, with an average yield of 139, and this is across dry land and irrigated. So a lot of yield potential there. And four of those 11 also got a quality award. So, you know, they not only produced high yields, they also produced the quality that the milling and baking industry is looking for.
And that's important. You don't want to just have a lot. You want to have it to be the high quality that you're looking for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We try to balance that in our breeding program. We're looking for that high yield potential. It's got to stand at harvest. I mean, that's an important test weight, protein content, and then the milling and baking characteristics obviously are key to make sure that the industry, both domestic and export, continue to thrive like they have.
Well, let's talk about growing wheat in California. And tell me about what are some of the things that growers are seeing this year, and what do they need for help?
Yeah, it's another dynamic year out there, you know. Certainly a lot different than what we've had, you know, with more rainfall, et cetera. The crop, as I understand it, I haven't been out there recently, but it's looking good. You know, our products continue to lead. We're pretty high share in that marketplace. We've got products like WB Pacheco, our Pacheco, which is a triticale, as well as, of course, our forage wheats, WB Patron, WB 9990, and a few others that are really, you know, for the dairies, they really like those products from feeding the dairy cows.
Yeah. You know, with the weather being as crazy as it has been in California this year, with these products, does that affect them much, or are they holding up pretty well?
You know, I think they're holding up really well. Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, you know, if you get underwater and stay underwater, nothing we can do about it. So we will have some of those spots. But I think in general, crop's looking good. We should have plenty of supply again for next year. You know, obviously we want to continue to supply the dairies and with the products that they're looking for.
Yeah. You know, there are some things that you just cannot control and you just cannot help. Like you said, if it's underwater, it's underwater. What about for some people who are planning for the future or maybe thinking, you know, what do we want to do? Maybe we want to do something next year or that we want to get into this for next year. Any suggestions?
Yeah, for the National Wheat Yield Contest? Yeah, no, absolutely.
Sorry, yeah. That wasn't clear at all.
No, absolutely. No, it's, you know, the website's up and running now through the National Wheat Foundation hosted. So I know it's active now. If they want to enter and they've planted Westbred, we support that entry. We'll pay for the contest entry. And then if they're a national winner, and we have had California winners before, they get to attend Commodity Classic next year on us and enjoy a great time.
Yeah, I would like to see a California winner again.
I absolutely would too. Yeah, we had first place state this past year with Westbred. Yeah. It just wasn't a high enough yield to get them into the national category.
Yeah. You know, I'd get in trouble if I didn't ask about something for Arizona. You got anything for Arizona for us?
Yeah, no, Arizona, certainly that same dairy market, same products really fit well in Arizona as well as California. So.
Good. Anything else that you think we should be talking about?
No, I'd just say, you know, if you're interested in the Westbred lineup and the Bayer lineup, you know, go out to westbred.com. It's part of the Bayer website network out there and our products. You can list your zip code and get drilled down or just talk to your local seed supplier. We've got a lot of them out there.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time. Commodity Classic is presented annually by the American Soybean Association, the National Corn Growers Association, National Association of Wheat Growers, National Sorghum Producers, and the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the USDA published its third trade outlook for the fiscal year of 2024. Chad Smith has more on what the numbers tell us about the state of U.S. agriculture.
The trade outlook for 2024 is unfortunately still showing the United States with a record trade deficit. Betty Resnick, an economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says 2024 will see lower agricultural exports.
There's still expected to be a record agricultural trade deficit of $30.5 billion and also an annual decline in agricultural export of about $8.3 billion to now $170.5 billion. And that reduction is fueled primarily by a reduction in both the value and volume of soybeans and soybean products, and also a strong U.S. dollar.
Resnick says this report includes some notable changes compared to the previous one issued late last year.
Overall, U.S. agricultural exports and imports, so both of them, are projected up $1 billion each. As for our exports, partners, U.S. exports to China were revised down by $800 million as compared to the previous report, while exports to both Mexico and Canada were increased. Mexico has almost caught up to China as the number one destination for U.S. agricultural products.
Resnick talks about what's driving the forecasted increase in trade income.
So the increase in exports in the February outlook are being driven primarily by an increase of about 4% or $1.4 billion in livestock and dairy products, driven by both robust exports and rising prices in those products, and an increase of $700 million in grain exports. These increases were counterbalanced by further declines in soybeans, which were reduced to $1 billion or 2.6% due to both falling prices and volume.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Conservation engineers are helping thousands of farmers and ranchers do vital environmental work. Gary Crawford has more.
I know it seems incredible, but a few days ago, somehow or other, a few of us did not pick up on the fact that from February 18th through the 24th, it was National Engineers Week. So what exactly is an engineer in the first place?
It's anyone who basically uses ingenuity to solve problems.
Ingenuity, engineer, get it? I heard what you did there, Kevin.
All right, let me try to do that one again, okay?
No, that was clever. Don't worry, we're going to introduce you formally in just a minute. So engineers come in all types and sizes, from the traditional railroad engineer to flight engineer, to those who build dams and roads and such. Now, let's meet Kevin Farmer. He directs conservation engineering for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Our engineers are conservation-type engineers, those who solve problems to help protect natural resources throughout the environment.
To that end, many of these engineers often work directly with farmers, ranchers, and others.
You know, helping folks do their thing with the land is awesome.
Awesome. New voice there, Andy Dykert, award-winning USDA state conservation engineer in West Virginia, a state with a lot of livestock. And so in that case,
we help the farmers with waste storage structures to handle their manure, and they can store that in structures until it's beneficial for them to spread it on their fields. We also help improve their water for their livestock. We may develop springs or help them build farm ponds with pipelines to watering facilities.
Many engineers also build and maintain flood control dams and things like that. Now, that's just a sample of the work conservation engineers do every day. In fact, sometimes there's more work than there are engineers to do it. The government is making record amounts of money available for farm conservation projects, and Kevin Farmer says the USDA is needing to find more conservation engineers to help producers with those projects.
And we're doing everything we can to continue to recruit more talented young students from the universities, and also to recruit other talented professionals in some of the higher graded positions that are not entry level. So we need engineers all across the board to help address the many resource concerns that we have today,
including concerns about the health of soils on farms and the quality of water supplies everywhere. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, more than 150,000 attendees from 190 countries were in Dubai, United Arab Emirates last week for Gulf Food, the world's largest annual food and beverage show. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom provides insight on what he describes as the busiest Gulf food show he's ever attended, with exceptionally large contingents from Africa, the Middle East, China, and North Asia.
Gulf Food 2024 in Dubai was yet again another, I think, record-breaking attendance. At least for the first 3 days, it looked like a much bigger attendance than any of the previous years I've been to. And a real, you know, people think of it as kind of a Middle Eastern African show, and it is, but it's really a global food show. Of course, you know, the same old questions that we've had the last year or so about supply, and, you know, with the downturn in the availability of production due to the drought. But with that being said, I think there was a really big appreciation of the opportunity to look at different cuts. You know, if they're used to middle meats, for example, maybe we could look more at the end cuts. If they're used to end cuts and can't get as many as they would like, why don't we look at beef variety meats? I think this sort of discussion was a theme and a real positive because, for the most part, the people in the trade understand what's going on with factors out of our control, and they're willing to work with us. So that was another real benefit of getting a lot of our members together with the trade in this venue to talk about these sorts of things.
Another benefit of FaceTime with Middle Eastern nations is gauging the economic climate of our trading partners.
I think the economies, it really depends on the country. And, you know, you look at the GCC, for example. You know, Saudi's doing quite well. You know, the UAE is doing quite well. And there is maybe some momentum, you know, economically there, despite all the headwinds throughout the region. But then you segue into some other areas like Jordan and Lebanon and, of course, Egypt, which is, you know, right there in the epicenter of a lot of the activity with the Suez Canal and this sort of thing. And with the Gaza situation, it's a little more of a concern, I would say. And there's no doubt that those economies are under strain. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this turns out. But I would say it was a mixed message economically, depending on where you're at in the Middle East.
Another issue in the Middle East causing trade disruptions is the avoidance of the Suez Canal by shipping vessels, hoping to avoid attack in the Red Sea. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The North San Joaquin Valley has received a AA BDO zone rating, highlighting strong potential for biomanufacturing, particularly in utilizing almond and tree nut biomass. The Bioeconomy Development Opportunity Zone centered in Modesto is supported by strong infrastructure and feedstock supply chains in the region. Through the assessment co-funded by Stanislaus County, Beam Circular, and the Almond Board of California, the goal is to attract investments for biomass-based industries like biofuels and specialty chemicals. The initiative aims to capitalize on the area's agricultural strengths and promote sustainable bioproduction. The rating highlights the region's readiness for large-scale bioproject development and its significance in the global bioeconomy. The analysis found ample potential for utilizing various biomass sources, including almond shells and fruit tree waste, for clean energy production. Nominations for the 4R Advocate Program will continue to be accepted through March 31st. Since 2012, the 4R Advocate Program has recognized 116 agricultural producers and retailers across 25 states covering 283,000 acres. The initiative aims to highlight and celebrate farmers who prioritize sustainable nutrient management, ultimately benefiting both their operations and the environment. Selected advocates will work with the Fertilizer Institute to promote awareness and adoption of 4R nutrient stewardship. Benefits for advocates include opportunities for media engagement, speaking engagements, on-farm events, and recognition at industry conferences. Ag retailers and growers are encouraged to nominate candidates who exemplify sustainable agriculture practices, fostering environmental stewardship while maximizing productivity. Nomination information is available at tfi.org. The recently launched bipartisan Agricultural Trade Caucus is leading an effort to urge the Biden administration to prioritize agriculture in its trade agenda by reducing tariffs and non-tariff barriers for American agricultural exports. A letter signed by 28 members of Congress, including co-chairs of the Ag Trade Caucus, emphasizes the need for enforceable agreements that open markets and lower tariffs, ensure science-based sanitary and phytosanitary regulations, and eliminate abuse of geographical indicators in the food sector. They highlighted the importance of global competitiveness for U.S. farmers and ranchers and called for proactive engagement to secure high-standard agreements with trading partners. The letter also expressed concerns about existing barriers in Latin America and Europe and urged the administration to address them to prevent further loss of market share for American producers. Even with the early successes of the LandFlex program, there's still more potential. Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt described how LandFlex can be further deployed.
We see so much potential with this program in multiple geographies, not just our critically overdrafted basins who are desperate to find a path to sustainability, especially on the timeline that Sigma has placed on it, but also expanding this program into other regions to assist with things like subsidence in Sac Valley, to get it in the hands of even our next tier overdrafted basins so they can get a jump start before they tip into critically overdrafted. But arming our growers and our water districts and our GSAs with a tool in their toolkit that provides flexibility and provides certainty for them and allows them to continue to plan and be ahead of the game. I think Sigma was seen as this axe that was about to fall, and we now have a tool that shows that it doesn't have to be that way.
A workshop on adapting fruit and nut production practices in the San Joaquin Valley to a changing and variable climate is coming up later this week. UC Cooperative Extension is hosting the Climate Smart Ag Meeting at the International Agri Center in Tulare on Thursday, March 7th, beginning at 8 in the morning. Attendees will have an opportunity to learn about the latest research and advances in management of climate change risks. Speakers include Cooperative Extension Advisors Jalendra Burjal, Mark Batney, Sandeepa Gautam, and Brent Holtz. Other scientists and experts from the Almond Board of California, USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, the California Pistachio Research Board, and LandIQ will also be providing additional information. Registration information for the Climate Smart Workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
There are catastrophic losses ahead from the Texas wildfires. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller announced his agency's commitment to providing support to the state's producers as they deal with the aftermath of devastating wildfires in the Texas Panhandle. The Smokehouse Creek fire has burned through almost 1,700 square miles of land, making it the largest on record in Texas going back to 1988. Seven grain and seed operations have reported total losses. Miller says the fires not only threaten lives and property, but will also have a substantial impact on the Texas agriculture industry. More than 85% of the state's cattle population is located on ranches in the Panhandle. Miller also says there are millions of cattle in the region, with some towns made up of more cattle than people. As Governor Greg Abbott declares a disaster in 60 counties, the TDA's State of Texas Agriculture Relief Fund is calling for donations to assist Texas Panhandle farmers and ranchers. Severe damage from January's polar vortex was front and center at the British Columbia Fruit Grower Convention held recently. Dennis Guy reports.
Canada's West Coast tree fruit and grape growers are asking the province for financial support following mid-January's short but severe polar vortex event. Tree fruit and grape growers have been hit hard with bud kill caused by that cold snap during a fairly mild winter. Temperatures across the southern BC interior dipped to near minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit between January 11th and January 13th. Low-lying regions like the Okanagan Valley and Creston Valley regions were especially hard hit, resulting in a high bud kill following that short but devastating cold snap. Frank Wolka has operated a fruit tree orchard in Creston Valley for more than 40 years, growing peaches, cherries, and apricots. Wolka says he has never seen such extensive midwinter bud kill in his life.
It was more or less what you would call a perfect storm. The most extensive freeze damage I've ever experienced in my life. Every one of those samples showed 100% bud kill. And that was on peaches, on apricots, on cherries.
BC Fruit Growers Association representatives have taken their concerns to British Columbia's Agriculture Council. Peter Simonson, president of the BC Fruit Growers Association, says an emergency government insurance program called Agri Recovery is in place. However, Simonson also says the extensive tree and vine damage now being seen will force many growers to replant and start their operations from scratch.
We're kind of almost beyond the point of no return. There is an emergency program called Agri Recovery. It was used during the Fraser Valley flood. It'll allow growers to hopefully do some replanting and compensate for some of the losses.
Bud samples at Vineyard Research Plots indicate the January freeze is worse than the late 2022 event that killed about a third of vineyards in the region and reduced last year's grape crop by more than half. Remy Cardinal, owner of the Redbird Winery in the Okanagan Valley, hopes to get by this year with a sideline of cider pressing from his apple orchard, but he says there will be no grapes for wine this year. Cardinal says farmers in his region will need all the support they can get from governments and from consumers to get through 2024.
It's a full year of no winemaking. We still have all the infrastructure, the staff to pay, but we don't have this revenue for next year. This is the year to buy low. Don't go to the big chain, buy local, buy from the growers, from the farmers.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
The Agriculture Secretary provides examples of USDA's Equity Commission final report recommendations and how they're designed to improve equity and inclusion within all aspects of the department. Rod Bain reports.
When it comes to USDA's Equity Commission's final report and its 66 recommendations to leadership, some have already been implemented within the Department of Agriculture. The remainder will be in the coming weeks and months. That's according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. But how are those recommendations designed to address issues of equity and inclusion? The secretary provided examples using illustration of how an impacted USDA customer should be seen for the individual they are and appreciated for that. For instance,
this commission charges us at USDA to see that black farmer in need of credit and perhaps not trusting the system to treat him or her fairly. We're entering into cooperative agreements through our Farm Service Agency office of organizations and entities that that black farmer can relate to. And that organization is saying to them, let us help you create a trusting relationship at USDA. We see that black farmer in simplifying our process, which is one of the recommendations of this report, making it easier for people to actually get the credit that they need.
Another illustration.
That Native American farmer wants to make sure that we see him or her in our conservation programs, that we can incorporate that indigenous knowledge in our standards and in our support, so in turn they can be in line with the heritage and their history.
Secretary Vilsack offers the illustration of a Hmong farmer asking a Farm Service Agency County Committee to review credit applications for discrepancies, only to find out that entity does not have minority representation.
We see that Hmong farmer because we've appointed minority members to county committees across the United States to ensure that there is somebody in the room with a point of view that can recognize when equity has not occurred. This report asks us to continue working on that structure to create equity.
And in viewing farm workers,
this report asks us to see those farm workers, and we are going to do that. Why? Because now we have a senior advisor in the secretary's office whose job and function is to make sure that this department continues to see in the work that we do and the policies that we develop our farm workers.
The complete USDA Equity Commission final report and its recommendations are found online at www.usda.gov/equity-commission/reports. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's a celebration of the work of a special type of engineer. Here's Gary Crawford.
I know it seems incredible, but a few days ago, somehow or other, a few of us did not pick up on the fact that from February 18th through the 24th was National Engineers Week. So what exactly is an engineer anyway?
It's anyone who basically uses ingenuity to solve problems.
Oh, ingenuity, engineer. I heard what you did there, Kevin.
All right. Let me try to do that one again, okay?
No, that was clever. And don't worry about it. We're going to introduce you formally in just a minute. So engineers come in all kinds, types, sizes, from the traditional railroad engineer to flight engineer to those who build dams and roads and such. Now, let's meet Kevin Farmer. He directs conservation engineering for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Our engineers are conservation-type engineers, those who solve problems to help protect natural resources throughout the environment.
To that end, many of these engineers often work directly with farmers, ranchers, and others.
You know, helping folks do their thing with the land is awesome.
Awesome. New voice there, Andy Dykert, award-winning USDA State Conservation Engineer in West Virginia. That's a state that has a lot of livestock, and so...
We help the farmers with waste storage structures to handle their manure, and they can store that in structures until it's beneficial for them to spread it on their fields. We also help improve their water for their livestock. We may develop springs or help them build farm ponds with pipelines to watering facilities.
Many engineers also build and maintain flood control dams and such, and that's just a sample of the work conservation engineers do every day. In fact, sometimes there's more work than engineers to do it. The government is making record amounts of money available for farm conservation projects, and the USDA is needing to find more conservation engineers to help producers with those projects. Kevin Farmer told us,
"We've been going through a big hiring surge as a result of the bipartisan infrastructure law." And
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. While I was out at Commodity Classic last week in Houston, Texas, I spoke with Brian Keel, Director of Government and Public Affairs for Pinion. Here's our conversation.
My name is Brian Keel. I'm Director of Government and Public Affairs for Pinion, which is a national ag business advisory company.
All right, Brian, you and I have spoken a few times over the phone, but today we are out at Commodity Classic being held in Houston, Texas, and you are out here talking with growers as they're coming by. What are some of the key topics you're talking about?
You know, there's really two big topics in terms of D.C. that are on the minds of growers. Number one is the farm bill. You know, where is it? Why don't we have a farm bill yet? When are we going to see one? I think right now our best bet is we're not going to see a farm bill till 2025. I mean, it's always possible we'll see one pop in the next couple months, but boy, the moons don't look like they're in alignment. The other topic is taxes. There is a tax bill that has passed the House of Representatives by a big bipartisan majority, and it has some really good provisions for farmers. It takes bonus depreciation back up to 100%. It has other tax provisions that a lot of farmers use. It's stalled in the Senate, and we're trying to get senators to pass the bill. We encourage people to talk to their senators and ask them to move that tax bill through the Senate.
Let's go into that a little bit more in detail about the tax bill. Tell me a little bit more about why this could be important for farmers.
Well, it has a number of provisions. So in 2017, Congress passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was a big tax relief bill back then. Unfortunately, a lot of those provisions are expiring, and they're starting to phase out now, and then they'll really phase out in 25 and 26. So, for example, one of the issues we're spending a lot of time thinking about and talking to our clients about is estate planning. The 2017 bill doubled the estate exemption and the gift tax exemptions so that people can really give away a lot of money during their life and not have Uncle Sam grab a big chunk. Those provisions go back to the original levels in 2025 and 2026. So those are things people need to get on top of and stay on top of. This tax bill doesn't address specifically the estate and tax and gift tax issues, but it does address bonus depreciation, which if you are buying equipment is a really big deal. How quickly can you depreciate equipment? So we want to see this provision passed, and again, we need the Senate to act on it.
Have you seen much movement in the Senate? Has there been any more support?
No, unfortunately, the Senate has stalled, and it's frustrating because the House, again, it was bipartisan. I mean, it was a blowout vote. Democrats and Republicans voted for it. The basic deal was there are business tax provisions that a lot of the Republicans like, and there are child tax credits that a lot of the Democrats like. So it kind of brought together this great coalition to get the bill passed. We're hopeful the Senate will pass it, but so far they've just been sitting on it for a month now, and we're frustrated because at some point we're too far into an election year and it won't pass. So if people care about taxes and want to see your taxes lowered, next time you're talking to your senator, ask him to get that bill moving.
Are you still hopeful for it?
I am, but I think it won't happen unless we really get engaged and put some pressure on the senators.
So speaking of things that won't happen unless we really get engaged, let's talk about the Farm Bill. How we're starting to see a little bit more talk, I think, now finally in this year about getting busy on the Farm Bill, but are we seeing any movement?
You know, we haven't seen a lot of movement. The chair of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson, has said he wants to bring a bill up. He wants to get it through committee. So that's positive. But we're really seeing election year politics already start to make an issue. And the further we get into an election year, the harder it is to see this bill passing. So if it doesn't happen in the next month, I think the best bet is second quarter of 25.
You know, I think I've been hearing from a lot of people that, boy, I just don't know if it's going to happen this year. But you're the first to actually say, you know, if it's not this month, we're looking at next year. And, you know, I think that that's probably very accurate because things are going to be lost as the election moves forward, right?
Yeah. I mean, the good news is farm programs are intact. Pinyon, we do a lot of work with farmers on farm programs and implementation, whether it's, all the programs, crop insurance, too. Nothing's going to change with them for the next year. We've got an extension on the Farm Bill that goes through September. So for the time being, everything's okay. It's just if it goes longer than that, it starts to get more iffy.
Right. All right. Anything else that our listeners should be aware of right now?
Well, the final thing we're really looking at and concerned about are trade issues. You know, international trade's a big deal. 20% of farm revenue in the United States comes from exports. So if we're not exporting as a country, we're losing. And our concern is it's been 10 years since the United States entered into a new free trade agreement that opened a new market. And during that 10 years, you know, China's entered into 16 free trade agreements and the EU's entered into, I think, 12. Everybody's out there cutting deals and the U.S. is standing on the sidelines. And this isn't a partisan issue. The Republicans haven't been doing it and the Democrats haven't been doing it. And I think the problem is a lot of the politicians view trade as, well, it's about factories and it's about workers and unions. We need to let them know it's also about farmers. And farmers, we need to be exporting our food. I mean, most people in the world don't live in the United States. You know, 95% of the mouths are outside the U.S. So if we're selling food, our market's outside our boundaries. So we got to push the administration, this administration and whoever comes in the White House next, we got to push them on trade.
Do you feel like we're hearing enough talk about trade? You know, actually, let me rephrase this, and I'm going to really put you on the spot here. I wonder this every time that there's an election. I want to hear from the candidates in talking about trade. Are we hearing from the candidates about trade this time around?
We've heard some things about trade, but unfortunately, they have not been good things about trade. You know, President Trump, one of his proposals is to put a 10% tariff on all inbound goods. It's a terrible idea. I mean, you may love Trump, you may think he walks on water. This is a really bad idea. Because if you put a 10% tariff on everything that's coming into the U.S., number one, everything becomes more expensive. So think about farm chemical inputs. All of that stuff gets more expensive. You think about anything we import. But then think about what other countries will do. If we start taxing them, they're going to start taxing us. And we saw that with President Trump's trade war in 2018 and 2019, all the retaliation that happened that really took a lot of money out of our pockets. Now, we papered over it with the market facilitation program, those payments, which was good. It kept farmers whole. But long term, I think we're starting to feel that bite because we've lost market share. And you know, you can write a check and you can subsidize for a while, but eventually it really catches up to you if you don't have the markets. Farmers need markets to sell to. So this tariff idea is just a terrible idea, and we gotta try to get them to back off of that.
How do we get them to back off of that? Do you think that should people be contacting lawmakers and asking them to please explain this, or how do we go about that?
I think all of the above. I think number one, Congress needs to get more involved in trade. And, you know, a really good thing happened last month. A bipartisan group in Congress launched what they're calling the Congressional Ag Trade Caucus. And that was two Republicans and two Democrats launching the caucus together, which tells you, again, ag trade is a bipartisan issue. You know, I had a boss who used to say, you know, the cow you're selling doesn't know if it's a Democrat cow or a Republican cow. It's just a cow, and you got to sell it. It doesn't matter what party you are, and that's true for trade. So to see Congress beginning to engage in a bipartisan way on trade is really important.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you again to Brian Keel, Director of Government and Public Affairs for Pinyon. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour now. For more from Commodity Classic, where I got this update on cotton.
So my name is Drake Copeland, and I'm a crop manager for FMC.
Well, let's talk about the Southeast region for cotton, and what are growers seeing, and what do you think can help them out this year?
Well, I think, you know, going into 2024, there's a lot of talk about commodity prices, and it opens up opportunities for crops like cotton. So with the prediction of corn acres being down, I think we'll see a lot more cotton, especially, you know, with prices right now. Decisions are going to be made day to day on whether they plant more acres and whatnot. But I think going into 2024, there's a lot of opportunity. Given the genetics that they have with the new varieties, if they're placed on the right acres, you know, our partners are in the seed business do a great job of doing that. But on top of that, you know, I think what we learned last year is pest control is something that is top of mind for everyone, especially with a cotton crop. That's something that we'll continue to talk about, continue to monitor, and keep solutions in front of our growers.
What about in California and that area, California and Arizona, if we can talk about the two of them together? Anything that growers should be thinking about there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity out there as well across the cotton belt. But I think one thing from an FMC standpoint that we have an offering for those growers out there for their western plant bug issues is a product called Carbine Insecticide from FMC. Really good product, safe on other insects in that system, and I think it's a solution that growers should look at in that cropping system out west.
Okay, so let's talk about the weather that we've had this year in cotton. And we've had a lot of rain. It's been a wetter year. So what kind of issues could that cause, and what should growers be doing?
Yeah, so with the El Nino pattern that we've had, I mean, that presents a lot of moisture, which causes, you know, in some cases we could see more insect pressure in 2024. We don't know that for sure, but it could set us up for that. And I think, you know, with prices and going into 2024, you know, people are making decisions, putting pencil to paper on what do I skimp back on. And I would say from a crop protection standpoint, insects are something that we've got to stay on high alert with, especially across the cotton belt, depending on if it's plant bugs in the mid-south or stink bugs in the southeast, or like we talked about, western plant bugs out west, something we want to stay on top of. And, you know, with those, you know, if you're a day or two late, that puts us in a bad situation. So that's something that, you know, I would stay on top of, given the weather pattern that we had over the last 6 months.
Yeah. And as you said, if you're a day or two late, I mean, we're talking a day or two late, you really don't want to take your time on this.
Yeah, and that's why we have consultants. We rely on them to be out in the fields, and they make decisions. Of course, there's logistics that also go into that too. But, you know, we have trusted advisors that have done a great job throughout the decades of producing cotton, and I think we'll continue to do so. So, yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I would say one thing when looking for FMC solutions, go to FMC Ag, agfmc.com. We have it segregated by crop, so you can click on cotton and see the other solutions that we have to offer if cotton growers are interested.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.